Well, the third presenter of this session, we have a rising senior, high school senior, and aspiring scientist, Timothy Campbell. And he will be sharing with us a shell game using past knowledge to inform the future. Would you help me welcome him?
Thank you. In order to care for creation, we kind of need to know what is there and how it works. If you don't, you tend to make significant mistakes or miss things. However, ecological data collection usually rather postdates major human impacts on the ecosystem because you kind of have to have people there to get the data, and they tend to change things before they actually get around to studying it. And earlier historical records may not be the most reliable sources of scientific information about something. If they're extolling the riches of a great new location, they're probably trying to convince you to move there. And for such purposes, we can use conservation paleoecology, which uses data from fossil and subfossil deposits to provide much longer-term historical perspectives on the environment and faunas or floras, which gives good baseline comparisons to detect changes. For instance, there was a relatively recent study looking at shells just off the coast of Southern California that noticed that there was a very significant change in what was present in the early 1800s, in that all of the species that do not like mud disappeared from the coast and now are only found on the Channel Islands. Now, why is there a lot of extra mud coming in the early 1800s? That's because there's now a bunch of agriculture there that wasn't before. Mollusks in particular provide a very good record of long-term history compared to other phyla, having durable and identifiable shells in a lot of cases, a very high diversity of about 100,000 recent marine species, and often pretty narrow environmental requirements. And here is a selection of various mollusks. Now, on to the specific focus of this talk, the Waccamaw Formation. It's a shelly, muddy sand, as shown in this picture of some of the sediment, with a rather patchy distribution in the coastal Carolinas. It's present within this area between the Cape Fear River and Georgetown. These individual dots are known sites with material from there, and the red four dots are ones where I have actually been able to examine material from. It was deposited seemingly between about 2.4 and 1.8 million years ago, based on correlating it with deposits in Florida, and it frequently sits directly on an upper Cretaceous clay and is frequently the uppermost fossil-containing layer, and thus there it is relatively easy to tell that there aren't shells from other layers mixed in, because the Cretaceous, all the shells are completely gone, and you can't really have any shells if you have no layers. So for a broader perspective on the stratigraphy, the Waccamaw Formation is a bit younger than the earliest appearance of the genus Homo, and a bit younger still than the formation of the Isthmus of Panama. The Pliocene seems to be the most recent time when the climate was fairly consistently warmer than it is now in the southeastern United States, based both on the molluscan fauna and the stable oxygen isotopes. These sea levels seem to have ranged from somewhat below the current, given that there are freshwater shells in now very much coastal deposits, to about 65 meters above the current level. Now, it seems that isostasy has raised the local area about 45 meters, both due to the plate as a whole tilting, because now we've got all these glaciers on the north end, and because there seems to have been a big chunk that broke off the bottom of the Appalachians in the Miocene, so now the local area is moving up as well. The climate overall seems to have ranged from about 4 degrees Celsius cooler to about 6 degrees Celsius warmer than it is now, but with much milder winters. This is soon after the formation of the Isthmus of Panama. So now we've got the Gulf Stream moving north instead of just going between North and South America, so the area got much warmer. However, in turn, strengthening the Gulf Stream seems to have contributed to increasing the amount of snow in the Arctic, which made it colder, and then we end up with ice ages. There are a number of different questions that this fauna or similar ones can help answer. For instance, what type of fauna lived off the Carolina coast under a relatively warm, stable climate, as opposed to what we have now of a cold, unstable climate? And what groups of mollusks seem to be more or less resilient against an unstable climate, given their extinction rates? Also, how have biogeographic and diversity patterns changed in the Northwest Atlantic since then? Have they changed?
And how large of a sample size would accurately reflect the diversity of a site like this or recent material from off the coast? There are some previous studies. The earliest descriptions of fossils are from the mid-1800s. However, the most recent reference that both has illustrations and broad taxonomic coverage was published in the 1940s. And most of those published records are just lists of names, which often contain unidentifiable names or wastebasket names, things that are known to be misidentified, or names where we don't know if they're accurate or not. So in specific examples, the name Turbinillusta, that's a placeholder for species, could refer to any of the six or the 40 other members of that subfamily present, which doesn't really help you tell which one it is. Ficus ficus is from the Indo-Pacific. It's not present here, but you can tell exactly what that is because there's only one member of that genus around. And then Yanagera virgulis, a somewhat more complicated case. My father will be talking about more of those tomorrow. But Yanagera virgula is the accepted name for Camastriata smith, which is not present in the Waccamaw. What is present in the Waccamaw is Camastriata emmons. Camastriata emmons is in the genus Cama. However, Yanagera virgula, or Camastriata smith, is a Jurassic oyster from Europe and is not in the Waccamaw, unlike some databases report. And then Plearitis centenaria is known from deposits a bit older than the Waccamaw and was showed up in one of these lists of names, and so we don't know if it's misidentified until we check the museum, and it turns out it is actually here. So, in general, checking museum holdings can verify or correct these or figure out what wastebasket names are. There are about 620 published names from the formation that we can verify, which is about the same or a bit lower diversity than the same latitude has now off the coast. So maybe things haven't changed much. They have. Intensive sampling of two sites that are about 100 meters apart and essentially only differ in who owns the land has produced about 920 species of mollusks, and examination of museum collections has added about 50 from other sites. And 520 or so of those 920 are not ones previously reported from the formation, and almost 300 do not have scientific names yet. Which means the diversity of the formation is thus somewhat over 1,200 species, which would fit right in the middle of the Caribbean. So maybe this site was just like tropical areas and it was a lot warmer. There are some specific groups that have diversity much like tropical areas. There are lots of species in the family Colobelidae and superfamily Marginaloidea, which is something you expect in tropical areas. But there are some problems with that, like that these members of those two families are in the wrong genera for a tropical area. And there are a lot of taxa that are very dissimilar to tropical areas. Nobody has yet found a true conch or a modulus. Cypriids, murocenes, and tonoids are extremely rare. There are only 5 species of cone snails known instead of 15 to 50 the way you would expect in the Caribbean. The genera Asterpe and Ilionassa are abundant, which is very much not something you see in the Caribbean today, but their preferences also seem to have changed somewhat in between, so maybe that's just informative. Busaconidae is quite diverse. There's only one species that makes it to Yucatan. They don't seem to be able to jump deep water, so there are none on the Caribbean islands. And then there are these weird things that are only known from boreal areas today. And then there are some things where I have no idea what's going on, and they are unlike anywhere today. For instance, the genus Pruna, which all of these seem to be in, has about 30 species present, which is perfectly normal for that subfamily, but they aren't supposed to be in that genus. They're supposed to be in the other genus in the subfamily. And then the relative proportions among 3 different families of turrids, Drilliidae, Mangeliidae, and Cypelotomidae is odd. It's about 6-7-4 instead of something like 2-5-3. And then Ilionassa and Frontis, the primary difference seems to be that a lot of them went extinct and have been replaced by other things, but we don't really know what, because if they don't have much in the way of living relatives, we can't really tell where they lived. And there's definite additional evidence that this fauna is somewhat poorly documented, because the research has uncovered 28 families of mollusks that nobody has reported from the formation before. This one's a little arguable in that the species is reported before, but nobody figured out what family it went in accurately before this, it would seem. and about 28 gastropod genera that no one has reported in the Western Atlantic before, including 18 that are undescribed. These two are known from Iceland, so you can argue about whether that's Western Atlantic or not. And 10 genera bivalves that no one has reported from the Western Atlantic, including 3 that do not have names, and 1 species, this one, that is not previously reported from the Western Atlantic. What's going on there? This particular genus of clams can spend 6 months as a planktonic larva, and the larvae regularly reach West Africa, starting out in the Caribbean, so one can probably make it across the other way. And there are a number of specific groups that are rather more poorly sampled than average. Epitoniidae and Eumemidae have both roughly doubled in known diversity, and pretty much all of those additions are among smaller members of the groups. Epitoniids eat cnidarians, and Eumemids are long-term ectoparasites or endoparasites on echinoderms, and are generally rather poorly studied because you have to grab a whole bunch of echinoderms to find. Truncatelloidea, which should really be in order, but they are grazers and are generally pretty well documented as smaller things go, and the change is more in proportion to the total increase to the formation. Mergentelloidea and Columbellidae have both also roughly doubled, or a bit more in the case of Mergentelloidea. We don't really know what Mergentelloids eat. Some of them eat worms, some of them seem to be parasites on fish. Columbellids, again, are grazers. Conoidea, otherwise known as a big can of worms, or better phrase, worm eaters, since they tend to be species-specific predators on polychaetes, has, again, roughly doubled. And pretty much all of them use a venom harpoon to paralyze the worm. If you've ever heard of cone snails doing that, those are in this group. Pyramidellidae, otherwise is known as giant mess that nobody works on or can manage to figure out, because you can't get DNA on them if you've just got shells, like we have for two-thirds of the species. They're essentially the marine equivalent of ticks and mosquitoes. They're short-term parasites on mollusks and polyplacophorans, and each one might parasitize 10 species. There are probably about 5,000 of them today. And then Galeomatoidea is poorly documented absolutely everywhere because they're generic small clams that live usually commensally in burrows with things, but there are a few weird ones that are parasites of the burrow dwellers. There are some that actively crawl around. In general, Galeomatoidians do pretty much everything that bivalves do that they definitely are not supposed to. This area generally seems to have had a much higher level of endemism than the recent does. The modern fauna of the Carolina coast has almost no endemics. It's essentially all cooler water tolerant species from the Caribbean, and then shallow water you have ones that tend to extend much further north. The Waccamaw Formation seems to be the final expression of a unique faunal zone in the Northwest Atlantic, with a mix of much more Caribbean-like taxa, temperate-like, or even boreal-like, more maybe not because it's poorly documented groups, and some very definitely seeming endemic groups. Okay, sorry, something went wrong with the graph here, but there seem to have been 2 significant pulses of regional marine extinction about 3.2 and 1.8 million years ago. This is supposed to be showing time and then overall extinction, so you'll just have to imagine a line with little spikes every 200,000 years. They keep going up to about there and there and there. And if we overlay on this the temperatures, those seem to very much correlate with significant drops. I note that these are very much estimated, but it would seem that those very significant drops in temperature correlate rather strongly with those extinctions. Part of that may be a combination of both the temperature dropping and shifts in the position of the Gulf Stream, because if the water drops down, the Gulf Stream moves further out to sea, and then it's not bringing as much warm water in close to shore. In general, shallower water species seem to have lower extinction rates than more mid-shelf ones, and this is probably because these shallow water species are much more acclimated to seasonal temperature swings, because if a species is used to it changing by 10 degrees Celsius in a year, it doesn't matter much if it does that in 10,000. Whereas if a species is used to virtually no change in temperature, it might have problems if it changes by 10 degrees Celsius in 10,000 years. And in particular, moon snails, whelks, olives, rainbow clams, cockles, coquinas, venuses, and surf clams all have pretty low extinction rates generally, and all like shallow water, at least most of them. Then conoidea, balloon today, and nutmeg shells all generally like deeper water, at least to get high diversities of them, and also generally have much higher extinction rates, at least for the ones that we have good documentation on, because we have very few deposits of very deep water things. Three genera in particular, Urosalpinx, Noetia, and Ilionassa, went from 8, 5, and 9 species in New Alcamont down to 1 in the area today. And there are about 60 genera that are no longer present between Cape Canaveral and Cape Hatteras. Now, some of those have the obvious excuse that they've recently been split off from wastebasket groups, or that they're tiny and obscure and nobody's noticed that they're different from something, or things like that. On a sample size, 1 liter of sediment typically contains about 250 species represented by fairly complete specimens. 10 liters seems to contain closer to 400 species, about 100 liters has about 600, and so far we've collected a bit over 800 liters, probably, that's somewhat estimated, to reach a little over 900 species. And if we graph that, it roughly follows the formula here with an R-squared value of about 0.982. Many ecological studies only identify species of genera, particularly on mollusk. However, most genera have rather variable requirements in their depth range or salinity or temperature preferences, and species are often much more specific. Not all species. There are ones that can have a depth range like known from just below the low tide line down to 1,500 meters depth, particularly scaphopods seem to do that. There are a number of ecological metrics that change rather significantly when looking at species versus genera. For instance, the level of overlap between two samples of the same size, or the rarefaction curves actually somewhat differ. This is a graph of the number of species with a given maximum size on a logarithmic scale, and it fits pretty well with a log-normal distribution with a mean of about 6.4 millimeters. Now, as a note on that, a lot of ecological studies will use a 4-millimeter sieve as the bottom cutoff for working with material like this, which means that about half of the species will never show up in it. As a further demonstration, in your typical meter of sediment, there are about 65 species that get caught in a 4-millimeter sieve, and about 250 that get caught in a 1-millimeter sieve. And the smaller taxa are not at all evenly distributed. They include far higher proportions of gastropods that graze on algae or the like, parasitic gastropods, whatever they're parasitizing, gastropods where nobody knows what they eat, whether it's they're probably grazing on things, maybe they eat detritus because they don't have eyes, and a few other reasons, and no idea, but whatever it is, it's weird, and it works practically everywhere, and it's worked since the Silurian, because there are recognizable members of the family in the Silurian. Maybe they're eating something of the Maya fauna, who knows. There are about 93% of the taxa that never reach 2 millimeters are in one of those categories, versus about 43% overall. I forgot to mention Galliumatoidea is another one of the sets in there. As a further demonstration, this is a variety of, say, somewhat smaller taxa I have. All of those are full adult size. And for reference, that's how big a dime is. So conclusions on this. The Pliocene fossil deposit can provide something of a model of the future, but with rather significant caveats that this is a longer-term warm climate that is stable rather than a very recently warmed unstable climate. Depth seems to be a very significant factor in extinction, so that is definitely something that needs looked into in recent species, whether mid-shelf tax taxa are experiencing more stress due to changes in temperature than shallow water ones are. And in general, detailed study is needed to characterize a fauna and very large samples. And that applies to pretty much everything in creation. If you don't look at the smaller stuff, you aren't going to find it. Biogeographic pattern seems to have changed rather significantly in the Northwest Atlantic in the last 2 million years, but not really anywhere else, which is especially odd. Perhaps that's due to the recent change in the ocean currents in the area. But Australia seems to be something of an extant parallel to the Carolinian Pliocene. Both are cooler water faunas that experience slow warming, in the case of Australia, because the plates moved closer to the equator, in the case of the Carolinas, because the currents changed. And both had very diverse faunas, composed primarily of cooler water taxa and with lots of endemics. Here are my primary references on conservation paleoecology, and not the 173 that I've so far used for identifying things and getting the systematic order, primarily because there aren't really any big compilations of this. And I would like to particularly thank Lyle and Susan Campbell, Joe Carter, Patrick Moffalett, Harry Lee, Linda McCall, Lynn Moore, the quarry owners, and the Florida Museum of Natural History for their assistance in this. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for Timothy? Yes, Keith.
It seems like with these kind of things, there's kind of a chicken and egg problem, mm-hmm. in that you want to use the fauna to determine something about the environment. And in a lot of this case, you're using the current environment to determine the environmental constraints on, you know, you have to know the environment in order to figure out what the environmental significance of the fauna is.
Yeah.
So where are we at that point? It seems like we're mostly working back from knowing the environment to understanding the ecology.
Now, part of that is we have a pretty good idea of what the global changes are in terms of how are the Milankovitch cycles behaving, what are the very long-term global shifts, whereas the local changes are a lot harder to tell what's going on there, because you can't use something like ice cores or the like to determine that, and you've got factors like isostasy and have these groups changed in their preferences over time. There are some groups that definitely have. Usually those are ones that have experienced significant extinctions where, okay, we seem to have, say for instance, the genus Elianassa, the recent one like salt marshes. But there are a bunch of ones in these deposits that seem to have been 30, 40 meters out at depth in the ocean. So they seem to have done things in the past that the one recent species doesn't. So yes, in many ways it is extremely challenging to work through. And that is very much a question that needs a lot of more work done than I can manage right now.
Yes. I think at the end you made a fleeting remark about climate change, but I wasn't sure if I heard that correctly. Could you expand on that?
Essentially, what I was thinking on that pertaining to how this can relate to that is that with current climate change, that's a rapid change in general temperatures, and it affects ocean temperatures as well as atmospheric ones. And if we look at cases where there seems to have been a relatively rapid change in the past, do we see any consistent patterns, and can we see this again in the present? So for instance, this would suggest that there needs to be some work done on, are things living at different depths experiencing noticeably different issues.
Okay, and what are we seeing?
I don't know. I'm unaware of anyone looking at that in recent.
That seems odd.
That's probably more of an I have not gone thoroughly looking for such studies, but I do know that no one's tried that with mollusks in the recent the specific area that I've worked on. Someone may have tried that somewhere where I would not have particular reason to look at the references, but certainly not southeastern U.S.
So one more question. You yes. went down a 1 millimeter sieve, and you got four times as many species.
Yeah.
If you went to a 0.1 millimeter sieve, would there be another four times as many?
No, and primarily that relates to just the sizes of what is around. Actually, for the sampling, I would typically use a 0.25 millimeter sieve.
Okay.
But the difference between the 1 millimeter and the 0.25 millimeter sieve, you're only adding maybe 20, 30 species that could get caught in a 0.25 millimeter sieve that are not getting caught in a 1 millimeter sieve. Because at that point, you're running into, there are very few mollusks that are that small.
So the world is not mollusks all the way down.
The absolute smallest is about 300 microns across. And I haven't found any members of that family. The smallest adult I've got is about 700 microns.
Okay, good.
What sort of information does looking at the mollusks and their fossilization give about other species or other phyla that are related to the life of the mollusk, either predators or even mollusk prey? Like what sort of information can this also give you about those other species?
Well, as a specific example on that, Conoidea, as I said, tends to be pretty much species-specific predators on polychaete worms. And based on that, there were a lot of species of polychaete worms around. And we have actually found one or two jaws from them in here. But again, polychaete worms don't fossilize very well in sand. And as another example, I don't actually have... okay, here's one you can see. The hole there in that shell is predation by one of two other groups of mollusks. They'll actually drill a hole into another shell to eat the animal. And there are other cases where, say, a crab has peeled away the shell, and you can tell that. There are some other groups, like octopods will also eat shells, but it's a lot harder to recognize that because they tend to leave much more irregular holes that will just look like it broke in some fashion. And then there are other groups besides mollusks around. There are echinoderm pieces, there are occasional teeth from vertebrates or, say, fish otolith ear bones or that sort of thing that you can look at as well. But I've mainly been looking at mollusks because there are a lot of them there.
I just might mention that if you're interested in publishing some of this work, you might consider the Journal of the Washington Academy of Sciences, that is Washington, D.C. They don't have any page charges, and they have size limitation, and that applies to anybody here. If you have papers like this, biological topics or science topics, they're open for publications.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments for Timothy? Well, if not, would you help me thank Timothy?